If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
He wins, he takes the car. I win, I take his finger. Is that so strange?
Leiningen, you're up against a monster 20 miles long and 2 miles wide, 40 square miles of agonizing death. You can't stop it.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Round up the usual suspects.
Silent Breed is people!
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast looks at movies between 1895 and 1990. We cover all mainstream and genre films, books, TV, and whatever else Terry gets obsessed about. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. The new voicemail number is 206-350-5440. Or you can leave messages on Skype at Paleo Cinema. All lowercase and no dash. This podcast may include swearing and adult content. So if you hear anything you don't understand, just fucking Google it.
Hi people, this is Paleo Cinema Podcast number 80. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we are looking at the F films in the A to Z project. So I've found two films that start with F. I've considered a number of other films that start with F and discarded them after watching them, but I've finally come up with a couple that should keep people relatively happy. So, as usual, this is the what's been happening around the place time of the podcast. So, what's been happening? I did my first gig for the ABC local radio Darwin gig, where I get called up every week by Ivor Cole and shoot the shit about a different movie. In studio, I went down to the ABC studio in South Bank in Melbourne, and got into what they call a TARDIS booth, which is a booth with a couple of microphones and some headphones and a cough button, and had a chat live to Ivor while he was in Darwin, and they recorded it live. He recorded it up there, and it's incredibly high quality sound, much better than when I phoned it in, so I've stopped phoning it in. And it was real good fun. Sal and I went down to South Bank. We found the place. We found a parking spot right outside. I do it at 6 p.m. on a Friday night, so it's recorded and then broadcast the following Thursday. So I'm going to let people know through Facebook and Twitter when that's going to be occurring. I usually give a half-hour warning so that people around the world, if they want to stream the audio from ABC Local Radio in Darwin, I'll send a link. And you can do that. So I didn't actually have one broadcast this week because we were setting up for the Friday night. And, yeah, it was fun. Ivor and I had to chat for about 10 minutes beforehand. Sal was in the booth with me. And we just kind of talked about Black Narcissus, the Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger movie, which I'm going to do when I get through the A to Z project. I really got to talk about that on the podcast because it's a film of great interest and was done under some extraordinary circumstances. So that was a lot of fun. We just talked about that for half an hour, and that's going to be broadcast next Friday, basically. And yeah, so every week I'm going to pop down there after work and have a chat with Ivor, then go out to dinner with Sal, and basically make a night of it. And it was a buzz. I mean, here I am in the same ABC studio as professional broadcasters use. And I got to see the control booth, which is like a NASA control system. If you're a podcaster and you ever end up with about $25 million to spare, set up one of those because they are fantastic. They've got little gauges and they go up and down when people are talking and the recording, and it's just fantastic. It looks basically like the, you know, a modern version of Colossus, the Forbin project. It really is a fantastic place to see. And, yeah, and it's a bit of a blast. I was very up after doing it because it kind of got me in the headspace of doing the radio thing professionally. It's not just talking to somebody on the phone. I'm actually in the studio with cans on and an enormous microphone in front of me doing incredibly high sound quality, if no other quality, work in doing that. And it was great fun. So I had a good time. Ivor had a good time. One thing I found out about Ivor this week, which is really interesting, apart from the fact that he used to be an Englishman, is he does a devastatingly good Oliver Reed impression. No shit. We're talking about, I think it's called Triple Echo. I'm going to find out the name of that. Hang on a sec. Yeah, the Triple Echo with Glenda Jackson and Oliver Reed, where he's kind of, you know, drinking a cup of tea with a biscuit and going dippy, dippy, dippy with the biscuit. And Ivor does a fantastic Oliver Reed. It just broke me up. He's a big Oliver Reed fan, so we're going to have to do that movie at some stage for the radio gig. But it really surprised me. He came out with that while we were sitting in the booth chatting after the recording. So really enjoying the fuck out of that that particular gig. And it's just really taken what I do to a different level for me psychologically. And I really do appreciate the experience of that. So what have I been watching? Let's get on to that rather than me just glorifying the fact that I'm on the radio once a week. Let me have a look here. I'll get the mizo out and I'll go backwards on my mizos. Let's see. Dippy, dippy, dippy. Okay, let's see what I got. Oh, yes, I just finished watching Ocean's 11, the remake, because I just got it on Blu-ray very, very, very cheaply. So I thought I'd watch that again. I did watch Big Trouble in Little China on Blu-ray. I got that, so I haven't been doing anything really deep apart from the stuff I've been doing for the radio. I watched Serenity, the Firefly movie, so that was good. Let me have a look here. Black Narcissus, of course, I've talked about that. Watched Evolution, the movie with David Duchovny and Julianne Moore in it, basically because I've got this thing for Julianne Moore. And it's never a bad thing watching her. I did see a really weird 1971 biker film called The Pink Angels about a bunch of stereotyped gay bikers who are going down to a drag cotillion in Los Angeles and get hassled by the cops and go through all sorts of weird experiences. It's just a weird little flick, and I like the fact that somebody actually bothered making a gay theme movie, even though it is sympathetic to them. It really kind of isn't politically correct in the modern way we think of political correctness. So I watched that. It's a bit of a guilty pleasure one. I did see a good modern sort of horror comedy called Tucker and Dale versus Evil, which I'm not going to spoil, but I am going to say, see it. It's funny. It really is funny. It kind of turns a whole bunch of tropes about horror films on their head, and it's really nicely, you know, it's not mean-spirited at all. It's a good fun film. I did also see Drive Angry with Nicolas Cage. I didn't see it in 3D. I saw it on download. And yeah, it's Nick Cage cashing a check and being weird and doing a couple of cool things, including shooting about 87 guys while fucking a woman. And it's pure exploitation. You don't expect anything else from it than that. A couple of the roles, particularly the guy playing the villain in it, aren't particularly good, though. William Fichtner's in it, and he is very, very good playing the accountant, who's kind of like the demonic equivalent of an angel who comes up to take souls back, and he has a lot of fun doing that, and he's always good to watch in pretty much any film. I did see The Cars That Ate Paris, the Peter Weir film, which some people know as The Cars That Ate People, which it was fun to revisit. I might even do it on a podcast at some time. It's about an Australian country town that basically lives on car wrecks. Stars John Millian and Terry Cavalieri and a few other people like that. And I remember when the film first came out, down at my local shopping centre, the Volkswagen with all the spikes on it, the VW Bug with all the spikes on it, was actually being displayed down at my local shopping centre. And I got to actually touch the Volkswagen, and the sheet metal spikes were very, very sharp. I did see Lindsay Anderson's Oh Lucky Man with Malcolm McDowell. I got a DVD of that, which is a lot of fun and very interesting. It's got Helen Mirren in it as well, and I'm going through a bit of a Helen Mirren phase because I also watched Age of Consent, Michael Powell's movie with Helen Mirren in it. I did see The Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires. It's one of the last of the old school Hammer films, and yep, it's a kung fu vampire movie, and just basically A Lesser Hammer. I did see Unknown, the movie with Liam Neeson in it, where he plays a guy who has a problem with his identity in Berlin, and there's lots of car crashes and shooting people and Frank Langella and all sorts of things like that. And yeah, it's a action film, not unlike Liam Neeson's previous action film too much, but yeah, it's an action film. Let me see. I did see Jaws 2 with Sal. We watched Jaws 2, which is, yeah, it doesn't age as well as Jaws 1 did, even though Steven Spielberg did ruin cinema with the summer blockbuster in that movie. Saw Minority Report with Tom Cruise because I wanted to look at the technology. I didn't particularly want to look at Tom Cruise or see a Spielberg movie again. But, yeah, it's okay. Let me also see what else we've got. I did see Face Off with the John Woo movie with Travolta and Cage in it, which holds up pretty well. When was it? About 96, 97, something like that. And, yeah, it's a reasonable action flick. John Woo really makes it work, and I'm not too sure. I think Cage is much, much more interesting than Travolta, though Travolta gets the majority of the screen time playing the protagonist. But, yeah, when Cage is on the screen, you can't watch Travolta, basically. I did see a movie I was considering for the F part of this project as well, Frogs, which starred Ray Milland and a very young Sam Elliott. And I saw this at the cinema way back when. And, yeah, it's not a bad little 1970s kind of nature takes its revenge against nasty human beings, particularly the white ones kind of movie. And, yeah, I kind of enjoyed it more than I expected to in some ways. So that was cool. I did watch Sweet Smell of Success, the movie with Burt Lancaster and Tony Curtis, and I watched that for the radio gig and enjoyed that as well. Really, if you haven't seen it, I think I've talked about it on the podcast before, but if you haven't seen that film, you really should. And then another guilty pleasure, Shakes the Clown, starring Bobcat Goldthwait. I saw Bobcat Goldthwait about 15 years ago doing a live stand-up gig in which he eviscerated Michael Jackson just after the pedophile allegations were made. And, yeah, he was very funny and very good. And there was a great moment where there were some people heckling him in the front row of the audience because they thought he was a coked-out, stoned idiot. And he stepped out of character for about 15 seconds and very politely told them off and then stepped back into character. So I think he's an underestimated talent, and maybe he's chosen his projects badly, but Shakes the Clown kind of has some chops to it. And having seen him do the live stand-up, I really do have a greater appreciation for the fact that the guy actually does have talent. Okay, let me see what else we got here. Dippy. I saw this thing, a movie called The Charlemagne Code, which is kind of like a German Indiana Jones come Angels and Demons come Da Vinci Code film, which was shown on World Movies here. It's subtitled, and it's a nice action film where basically they're trying to find the treasures of Charlemagne in Germany, and hero, he's kind of geeky, computer nerd sidekick, and his very attractive girlfriend, played by Bettina Zimmerman, who is very, very attractive, go searching for Charlemagne's treasure, and it's a lot of fun. It shows you bits of Germany that people maybe weren't aware of. It's a sequel to another movie as well. The Charlemagne Code is a sequel to a movie whose name escapes me now. But there are going to be three of these films, all starring the same character, whose first name is Ide. I forget the last name. But yeah, they're good little exploitation films, and just because they're not in English, it doesn't mean they can't be a bit of fun action to them, and I did enjoy that a fair bit. So I have seen a lot of films, and the main reason I've seen a lot of films is I've had the flu. Not like heavy going flu, but you know, like one of those bugs that keeps you off work for a few days, and basically I've spent five whole days on the couch self-medicating with, you know, treating the symptoms kind of medications, and got to see that many films this time around. So I'm going to take a break now. And when I get back from the break, I am going to have a chat about Flight of the Phoenix, which is the first of the two movies. I'm going to tell you what the other one is after I've talked about Flight of the Phoenix, the 1965 version, not the 2004 version.
happy, my love. Let's say that our little show is over, and so the story ends. Why not call it a day? A sensible way, and still be friends. Look out. Darling, why should you cling to some fading thing that used to be? If you can't forget, don't you worry about me. Look out for yourself. Give your heart and your love to whomever you love. Don't be a fool. Darling, why should you cling to something that used to be? If you can't about me.
Did he really sing "To Whomever You Love"? In that, that's Vince Edwards, the guy who was in Hammerhead, one of the Eurospy movies that I like so much. Singing Don't Worry About Me. He did one album. I'm not surprised. But it's not a bad voice, but a little bit influenced by Johnny Ray, I suppose. But yeah, so I found that recently, and I thought I'd play that for your delectation. Okay, let's get on with Flight of the Phoenix. This is the 1965 version, of course, directed by Robert Aldrich, based on a novel by Elston Trevor, who we've talked about one of the movies based on this guy's books before, because he's one of his pseudonyms is Adam Hall. And I talked about the Quiller Memorandum a number of podcasts ago, and he wrote that as well. He had a number of pseudonyms: Adam Hall, Simon Rattray, Howard North, Roger Fitzalan, I suppose Alan Fitzroger, Mansell Black, Trevor Burgess, Warwick Scott, Caesar Smith, and Leslie Stone. So he basically couldn't settle on a name particularly. But basic plot of this, in case you haven't seen the film, do. It's an aeroplane crashes in the Sahara Desert full of an old pilot, his navigator, a couple of army guys, and a few engineers and other kinds of workers on oil rigs. And they're trapped in the desert, nothing to do. It's a little bit kind of like Sands of the Kalahari right up to a point. And then one of their characters, an engineer played by Hardy Kruger, figures out that maybe they can piece together a smaller aeroplane out of the wreckage and fly their way out of there. And it's the story is all about the, you know, kind of the despair of people in very desperate situations, the incredible hardships they go through, and this kind of audacious and more than a little crazy plan for them to build a new aircraft, haul it over a bunch of sand dunes, and fly out of there in it. There's a fantastic ensemble cast in this one. James Stewart as a pilot, Richard Attenborough is in it as the navigator, Hardy Kruger, of course. Best role of Hardy Kruger's career, this one. bar none. Ian Bannon, playing a Scotsman. Ian Bannon was nominated for an Academy Award Best Supporting Actor for this and didn't win, unfortunately. It's also got Ernest Borgnine in it for a while, and Peter Finch, good old Finchy, and Dan Duryea. So, yeah, it's a fairly long film, 142 minutes, so it goes well over 2 hours, but there's not a slow bit in it. It really does move along at a good pace there, and, yeah, it's... I don't think it's a perfect film by any means. I think there are some bits where maybe the scripting could have been tightened up somewhat, but really interesting film, and just watching the way the guys go through this and the character arcs for each character. I mean, they're running short of water. They've got tons of food because there's a shipment of dried dates there that they can live off, and living on a diet of dates is probably not good for your digestive system at the best of times, but the water's running out. One of the guys has got a pet monkey, so they've got a little bit of a pet monkey comedy relief thing happening there. And really, I think this movie works for a few reasons, one of which is the kind of gravitas that and the seriousness with which everybody takes the thing. James Stewart playing one of his kind of flawed character roles. Really, he's an older pilot. He may be, his personality hasn't really suited him to go on further in his career. Somewhat grumpy, somewhat aged. He's had a very long career as a pilot, but he's coming towards the tail end of it now and really lacks self-confidence, and maybe has made a bit of pilot error in getting them into the situation they're in. Richard Attenborough is very good as his co-pilot, who's an alcoholic, but kind of comes good when the booze stops and really, in some very crucial scenes in the film, holds things together. Peter Finch playing a very upright English military guy, which is kind of a slight variation for Finchy at the time. You can see in this film too, he's starting to grow that goatee he wore in another film, The Legend of Lila Clare with Kim Novak, which is a very bad film I've got a slight fondness for. Ernest Borgnine playing a trucker, a guy called Trucker Cobb, who maybe has some mental issues. Well, he definitely has some mental issues on there. The supporting cast is good. Ian Bannon playing Ratbags Crowe, who's kind of smart ass of the pack, really, and Ronald Fraser, an English character, playing Sergeant Watson. They're all great in this film. Very limited cast, as you can see. It's kind of like a plot in a bottle. They're in one location with one problem, essentially, and really it's a pressure cooker for the characters of these characters, I suppose. I'm going to play a little bit of audio from it. This is where they're kind of coming up with this crazy idea to kind of, you know, get the aeroplane. The guy who thinks it up, the Hardy Krueger character, is called Dorfman. And they're kind of coming to terms with this insane but only option plan to build a new aeroplane out of the wreckage of the old one. So I'll just play that for you now.
The port boom is undamaged, and so, of course, are all the port side components. If we remove the starboard wing and attach it to the port boom and perform a similar operation on the tailplane, you'll see that we'll have the basis of an entirely new and aerodynamically sound structure. Is that understood?
Oh, absolutely.
We need only to clear the port engine of the sand that choked it in flight. The Kaufman starter is serviceable, and we should have no difficulty starting up the engine. And if we don't waste too much fuel on signals to Captain Harris, who is unlikely to be in any condition to benefit from them, we shall have enough of that as well. Now, most of the hydraulic fluid has leaked away, but I have worked out direct rudder and cable control, so that is no problem.
All right, now, what are you going to use for an undercarriage?
Our last landing rendered the undercarriage unserviceable. However, there's enough H-section in the cargo monorail and hull engines to make up a skid cradle for takeoff.
Skid cradle?
Well, skis, Mr. Moran. Skis. In order to take off, we shall have to move the final structure to the valley beyond that far dune. The surface there should be adequate. Now, as to whether it will fly, as far as the general design factors are concerned, there are no special problems.
I really like Hardy Krueger in this film. He's the one person who's has the idea and stays focused to it. And he's got an almost kind of Asperger's focus on this idea of getting them off the ground and into the air and building an aeroplane, and he's thought through the problems and he's made plans and he's done calculations and he's really kind of done everything but the grunt work by the time the other characters are even aware there is a plan. He's just kind of monomaniacal about that. He's determined to survive and he's got that incredibly intense focus about it, and he feels very offended because a lot of the other characters really doubt him and are very skeptical about his ability to pull it off and the ability for it to be able to be done at all. And he is, in a sense, the realist among the people on this, in the sense that he knows this is their only chance and they've got nothing better to do with their time. They can sit down and die, or they can do as he suggests and build this crazy kind of jerry-rigged aeroplane to get them off the desert and to safety, because the nearest place of safety is hundreds of miles away and there's no way anyone's going to walk across the desert with limited water supplies several hundred miles. So, yeah, it's a cracking little story. There are a whole bunch of these in the middle 1960s and I've been trying to figure out why. And here's one of my theories. You've got to consider, let's take a ballpark date of 1965. The guys who fought World War II are in their 40s at this stage. They're all in their 20s by the time the war ended 20 years before, and they're in their 40s now. And the most exciting things they ever did in their lives happened in their youth. And there's a kind of groundswell of stories that really have this intense nostalgia for the World War II hero generation. The people that lived through incredible hardships and incredible bravery and incredibly nightmarish circumstances and came out the other end of it. And a lot of the heroes you see in these kind of 1950s and 1960s action films, at least the ones set in contemporary times, are, you know, guys in their 30s and 40s who are war veterans and who really have a skill set and an attitude that hasn't fully been used since in the last 20 years. And so there's this incredible richness of action films at that time, not based on couch potatoes vicariously getting their adventure kicks, but as a nostalgia thing for hundreds of thousands, if not millions of men and some women who lived through incredibly dangerous and heroic circumstances only two decades before. So there's always a thing to consider with 1960s serious action films, even things like The Great Escape and The Longest Day and those kind of things. The men, and some women, of course, but mostly the men, who did these heroic and crazy and audacious and dangerous but ultimately important things were still alive and were still in the prime of their lives, but they just hadn't been to those headspaces since the end of the war. And I think there's an intense nostalgia factor for a lot of those men in enjoying these films, and they were incredibly popular at the time too. It really is a kind of artifact of the 1960s that occurred. I mean, and I suppose the James Bond phenomenon really bore into that too. I remember when I was a kid and the James Bond mania was about, some of the people who read Ian Fleming's novels most assiduously were men in their 30s and 40s. I really did get into them, apart from the kind of sexiness of them. They really did get into them, and they had been in, if not World War II, then some of them were in Korea, and some of them even were in Vietnam and had just got back from Vietnam at the time. And yeah, there's this kind of attachment to that kind of a story for those men of that generation, which makes it really interesting to view it from that point of view. And the Peter Finch character, who is a kind of gung-ho by the numbers and not incredibly bright military man, is a nod to that as well, in the sense that people probably knew somebody like that who would ultimately get himself and other people killed for being strictly a stickler to the rules and not being adaptable to circumstance. So I like the film from that point of view as well, and it's beautifully shot. The cinematography is fantastic. The music by Duvall is good, including Connie Francis singing Senzafina, a song that appeared in both in this movie and also in, I think, about a 2001 film called Ghost Ship with Gabriel Byrne in it, which Senzafina is used very differently in those two things. If you've ever seen Ghost Ship, it's this, the Italian love song they sing at the start of the movie. I'm not going to do a spoiler, but maybe check that film out just for the interesting use of an Italian love song in that film. And one of the other things about this film too is that one of the pots died during the making of the film. There was a special kind of jerry-rigged plane made for this particular film. It is called, he said, looking this up, of course, because for some reason the website, the web page I want isn't where I want it. Here it is. The aeroplane was called Talmadge Phoenix P1. It was a purpose-built plane built out of bits of other planes by Paul Mance and Frank Talman, who had run a small kind of aeronautical company in California, in Long Beach. And Paul Mance was piloting the film for part of the stunt work as the Phoenix plane is taking off. And hit the top of a sand dune and plowed the landing gear into the sand dune and tumbled the plane and died. Unfortunately, they did discover that there were a few things wrong at the time, including the fact that he had had a number of drinks. And so he was alcohol affected at the time of the accident. But it was one of those movies, one of the first movies where they had an on-screen recognition of the fact that somebody died in the stunt work during the making of the film. At the end of the film, they've got a screen saying, "It should be remembered that Paul Mance, a fine man and a brilliant flyer, gave his life in the making of this film." So it was one of the movies, for that reason too, it was one of the films that started tightening up the safety standards for stunt work and really gave people a reality check on that some of these things are dangerous and, hey, we should really kind of be a little more careful about how we do this kind of thing. So ultimately some good, I suppose, came from that thing. I mean, it wasn't the first time a stunt had gone wrong in a film. Let me see what I got. There's a movie called The Skywoman in 1920 where a plane crash killed a stuntman. Noah's Ark, 1928. Three people died, one man lost a leg, and a number of injuries were in the scene where hundreds of extras were caught in the Great Flood. Wizard of Oz, Margaret Hamilton was badly burned during a scene and her character vanished in a burst of flame and smoke. Buddy Ebsen had an analogy to aluminium dust used for the makeup when he was going to portray the Tin Man. Heather West was one. Stuntman Bob Moran, husband of Yvonne DiCarlo, was seriously injured and lost a leg during the filming of a gunfight on a moving train. Chains holding logs on a flatbed car broke, crushing Morgan as he crouched beside them. So, yeah, any number of films, people have been damaged. And if you go looking around the Internet Movie Database and Wikipedia, you'll find that a number of people have croaked during the making of movies. It's not the most safe occupation for certain people in that industry. But anyway, that's about all I wanted to say about Flight of the Phoenix. Good, solid adventure flick, great ensemble cast, and I think that any adventure flick really needs a good ensemble. I think that adventure movies that, with maybe the exception of movies like Die Hard, that focus on one individual have a kind of less of a cachet than an adventure flick with a good ensemble. I mean, look at The Dirty Dozen, The Magnificent Seven, The Great Escape, The Guns of Navarone, The Longest Day. All of those kind of films really do get together a bunch of interesting actors playing interesting characters. And the story is carried along a broad front because of the various character arcs of those different actors. So anyway, that's about it for Flight of the Phoenix. I'm going to take another break now and come back with a second film, which, in keeping with at the moment what I'm doing, is trying to stick a genre film into each podcast. I'm looking at François Truffaut's version of Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451 as the second F film for the A to Z project. So I'm going to take a break. I'm going to play Senzafina, sung by Connie Francis, and then come back and have a chat about François Truffaut's most unhappy filmmaking experience. La, 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 la.
Okay, let's talk about Fahrenheit 451, the 1966 movie directed by François Truffaut. Not to be confused with Fahrenheit 9/11, which was a stupid title for a Michael Moore documentary. Basically, it was François Truffaut's first and only English language film. It was based on a novel by Ray Bradbury. Basically, the plot is it's set in a dystopian future where firemen light fires rather than put them out, and the firemen are lighting fires because books have been banned. Every book has been banned. The written word has been banned from society, and the firemen are there to destroy all written material. And it's a bit of a one of those kind of if this goes on concepts that were very popular in the 1950s when the novel by Ray Bradbury was written. Everyone, of course, had seen book burnings done by the Nazis in documentaries in the 1930s. And Bradbury came along with the concept, well, let's take this to the ultimate extreme where all books are burnt, not just the ones that are deemed subversive, but society being controlled by the fact that they had no access to the wisdom of the past and or anything even remotely resembling a scripted fiction. And that's the premise of the movie. It was, as I said, a very unhappy experience for Truffaut, and I'll explain why after I go into a few details on who's in it and what it's about. Cinematography is very good in this one. It was by Nicholas Rogue, of course, who went on to direct a number of films, including Walkabout and The Man Who Fell to Earth. But the stars are Julie Christie, who'd recently won an Oscar for no discernible reason. Cyril Cusack, a very fine Irish actor. Anton Differing is in this film, and horror fans will know Anton Differing from a number of movies he did. He did a few Hammer films, but a lot of British kind of horror films in the 1960s and 1970s. Unfortunately, Anton Differing, for some reason, is dubbed in this movie. And I'm not sure why. He did have a slight Germanic accent, which the other star of the film had as well, Oskar Werner, who was actually Austrian. But maybe that's the reason why they did it. But Anton Differing showing up with a dubbed-in voice doesn't sound right at all. Anyway, so basically, and the other star, Oskar Werner, is the main star. Oskar Werner had starred in Jules and Jim with Truffaut in 1961. Interesting thing too, the actor's in his mid-40s in this film. He's about 47 years old, and he's really came into his own at the age of about 40-41 in Jules and Jim. And Oskar Werner was a kind of limited and unfortunate actor in a lot of ways. He was an alcoholic, and working again with Truffaut, Truffaut found him impossible to work with. He had weird ideas about how his character should be played. He had an inflated sense of his own importance because four or five years before, he'd been in Jules and Jim, and that had made him in some senses an international star. He'd been in the spy who came in from The Cold with Richard Burton and Claire Bloom previous to this film. And Oscar Werner had it in his head that he wanted to play this role very robotically, because it's set in the future, and of course in the future people will be robotic, which is probably one of the worst actor choices I can remember hearing about in a while. Now, Julie Christie in this film is incredibly wooden. Don't know why. I think I might know why, but I'm not entirely sure. It could be because Francois Truffaut had difficulty with the nuances of the English language because he didn't speak it very well. If you saw him in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, his English isn't very good, which is unfortunate when you're trying to direct an English language film. So maybe the nuance of character was difficult for him to portray to his predominantly English-speaking cast. And Truffaut actually wrote a diary of the film, and it was published in the English and French versions of K.S. the Cinema. And really, he just had a nightmare making this film for a number of reasons. He called it his saddest and most difficult filmmaking experience, mostly because of that conflict between himself and Oscar Werner. But there were some bright spots for Truffaut in this film as well. He really enjoyed working with Cyril Cusack, and you can see it in the scenes that he does with Cyril Cusack that he has an immense fondness for the actor, and they had an instinctive rapport between each other as well. Cyril Cusack gets all the best lines, and he plays it slightly large, and he plays himself like a pompous, self-important middle bureaucrat, which of course the character is, but Cyril Cusack actually got what the character was supposed to be and got what Truffaut was trying to get at in a lot of ways much more strongly than the other main characters. I'm just going to play a bit of Cyril Cusack discussing how and why books became banned. He's in a house with the firemen, and they're about to burn the house down because it's holding a secret library.
Of course, all this, the existence of a secret library, was known in high places, but there's no way of getting at it. Only once before have I seen so many books in one place. I was just an ordinary fireman at the time. I wasn't even qualified to use the flamethrower. It's all ours, Montag. Listen to me, Montag. Once to each fireman, at least once in his career, he just itches to know what these books are all about. He just aches to know, isn't that so? Well, take my word for it, Montag. There's nothing there. The books have nothing to say. Look, these are all novels. All about people that never existed. The people that read them and makes them unhappy with their own lives, makes them want to live in other ways that can never really be. Come on, Montag. All this philosophy. Let's get rid of it. It's even worse than the novels. Thinkers, philosophers, all of them saying exactly the same thing, only I am right. The others are all idiots. One century, they tell you man's destiny is predetermined. The next, they'll say that he has freedom of choice. No, it's just a matter of fashion, that's all, philosophy. Just like short dresses this year, long dresses next year. Look, all stories of the day, biography that's called, an autobiography. My life, my diary, my memoirs, my intimate memoirs. Of course, when they started out, well, it was just the urge to write. Then after the second or third book, all they wanted was to satisfy their own vanity, to stand out from the crowd, to be different, to be able to look down on all the others. Ah, Critics' Prize. Ah, this is a good one. Of course, he had the critics on his side. Lucky fellow. Just tell me this, Montag, at a guess. How many literary awards would you say were made in this country on an average each year? 5, 10, 40? Hmm? No less than 1,200. Why, anybody that put pen to paper was bound to win some prize someday. Ah, Robinson Crusoe. The Negroes didn't like that because of his man, Friday. And Nietzsche. Ah, Nietzsche. The Jews didn't like Nietzsche. Ah, here's a book about lung cancer. You see, all the cigarette smokers got into a panic, so for everybody's peace of mind, we burn it.
That's a great little speech there, and it's a great piece of acting too. You can sense the pettiness and the envy and the emptiness of the character really, really well when he does that. And of course, the way we can read that scene now is that it's political correctness gone mad, that everything anybody could be offended by is wiped out of culture because it could offend somebody. And the ultimate way, of course, to do that is to make sure that nobody writes and nobody reads anything. So that's the kind of essence of science fiction right there in the way that that speech and that little piece plays out. It really does redeem this film from the kind of sterility and the faults that it does have as a piece of cinema. And the fact that the two protagonists are kind of boring. And Julie Christie plays two roles in this. She plays Linda Montag and a lady called Clarice, who's a closet revolutionary. And she plays them pretty much exactly the same, which is and maybe an unwise choice. I mean, there's some bad acting choices in this film. There really are. Between Oscar Werner deciding to play things like a kind of Teutonic robot, and Julie Christie playing two should-be different characters pretty much identically, really saps energy from the film. That's brought back in by a couple of things, one of which is Cyril Cusack playing the captain, who's not named in the film, he's just called the captain. And a couple of other bits and pieces, including the set piece where the secret library is burnt along with the house, which its firemen are informed has been condemned. And the owner of the house is a kind of matronly lady who refuses to leave. And when the firemen are pouring kerosene all over the books, she stands in the middle of the pile of the books and lights a match. And that scene is incredibly vivid and has a kind of spooky, ugly, eerie beauty to it in an odd way. Just watching the pages of the books curl and wondering if they're being lost to things forever. There's an incredible power to that scene, which shows Truffaut's strength as a director. And at one stage I will do another Truffaut film. There's one other Truffaut film that I really want to do for the podcast, being The Bride Wore Black, but I'll leave that for now. And the other thing is that the kind of sense of a sterile dystopian future, part of the movie has a really groovy underslung monorail. The monorail is actually slung beneath the track, and a ladder basically disgorges from the belly of the train so that the people can get on and get off of the monorail train. And that was actually done as a test. There was a test track in France where they were testing this kind of a monorail to be used as a public transport system. It was never taken up as a public transport system, of course, but it does look incredibly groovy and futuristic and kind of right for this weird, ugly, sterile suburban future that Truffaut creates around the Ray Bradbury novel. And the film was nominated for a Hugo Award, in fact, for Best Dramatic Presentation in 1967, along with The Fantastic Voyage and three episodes of Star Trek. It lost out to Star Trek episode The Menagerie. Martin Scorsese actually called it an underrated picture, and he said it's had influence on his own films. It'd be interesting to find out exactly where, I do like the film. Every time I watch it, I kind of notice new things about it. Things like the fact that the titles at the start of the film are read rather than shown on the screen. So there's no written anything anywhere apart from in the books that are being burnt in this movie. So it's kind of an interesting way to start the film. And it has a slight feel of Alphaville about it in that initial narration where a kind of very formal upper-class English voice narrates the opening titles. Anyway, I mentioned the interesting casting choices in this film. There were some other people being considered by Truffaut for the roles in Fahrenheit 451. Apparently Charles Aznavour, who had been in Don't Shoot the Piano Player with Truffaut, said he was considered for the role that was eventually given to Oscar Werner.
He said that Jean-Paul Belmondo was the director's second choice, but the film's producers refused on the grounds that both of them were not familiar enough for an English-speaking audience. Paul Newman, Peter O'Toole and Montgomery Clift were also considered for the role of Montag. Terence Stamp was actually cast for it, but dropped out when he feared being overshadowed by Julie Christie doing two roles. That's alleged. That one hasn't been confirmed. But Laurence Olivier, Michael Redgrave and Sterling Hayden were considered for the roles of the captain before Cyril Cusack was cast. So, yeah, really interesting stuff there. Most of the film, apart from the bits on the French test track with a monorail, were filmed in England, in South London, Berkshire, and a few other things, a few other places like that. So, yeah, I like the fact that the film's set in wintertime as well. I think there may have been a deliberate choice to that kind of stark with the deciduous trees all stripped bare and that kind of thing really adds to the ambience of the kind of miserable future that these people are living in, where they have interactive wall screen televisions and comic books to read that don't have any words on them and little bedside TV screens about the size of an iPad screen and kind of groovy little bits of futuristic design like that, and the things like the fire brigade house has a symbol in front of it that looks a bit like either a salamander or a fire dragon, being the symbol for the fireman, and the numbers 451 for the alleged temperature at which paper burns. So yeah, I mean, the film could have been much better, and you can say that in retrospect about any number of particularly science fiction films at the time. It's easy to kind of Monday night quarterback on these things and pick them apart and find ways that they could be improved, which I suppose is the reason why a lot of movies get remade, because somebody comes along and says, hey, that could have been better if they'd done this, and then goes along and does it. But this film, I really think, I'm not sure it could be remade for a start, and I'll tell you why. Towards the end, they find a group of book people who basically memorize and recite books so that the books can't be lost. So, and everyone takes on the names of a book. So, you know, one person will be called Pride and Prejudice, and another person will be called Tales of Mystery and Imagination by Edgar Allan Poe and all that kind of thing. And this conceit's actually in the Bradbury's novel, but I think it's kind of silly. Memorizing books isn't a way of ensuring their immortality. A book can be then destroyed by a bullet or a car accident or a small metastasizing cell in somebody's body. It really kind of, yeah, it's an incredibly fragile way of preserving data, getting people to memorize it. Memories aren't perfect, and even if people do memorize a book, it can only be told to a small audience at a time. I mean, but you'd be much better finding some kind of metal and etching the book onto sheets of metal, or even just hiding caches of books at specific locations to really preserve them. I mean, there are any number of ways. These days you could do it with a whole bunch of thumb drives and just have caches of thumb drives. Data and books in particular are so easy to reproduce now that you couldn't remake this film as a futuristic film anymore, because we've moved past paper books to a large extent, as I'm finding out the more I enjoy my Kindle and the more that we're reading off screens and things like that. You, like a lot of other things, the written word has so many forms these days that you just simply couldn't do that now. It's gone beyond the realm of possibility to destroy information with a 100% certainty, as of course we know from the News of the World scandal is going on right now. The fact that these people accessed message banks for people's mobile phones and home phones and things like that, it's all coming out now because basically people have got more and better ways of investigating anything to do with any kind of information. So that's about it for this time around on Fahrenheit 451. I think it is an interesting film to watch. I think it's an interesting failure. And it's a movie that really kind of sits oddly in the career of François Truffaut as a director. A lot of his other films are much better, but this one, I think, suffered because of the language difficulty he had, his choice of actors in some cases, and the fact that the novel which ends in a kind of nuclear war, which the movie doesn't reproduce. I don't think it's a particularly important film, but I think it's a quite an interesting one. I think if you haven't seen it, it is worth catching up with. And there are some nice little bits of observation, nice little bits of kind of speculation in the movie. I haven't read the book for ages, so I can't really say whether a lot of those little nuances are in the book. But it is worth checking out if you get an opportunity to. So that's about it for that one. By the way, it is available on DVD, so you shouldn't have too much trouble with that. I'm going to take another break now and get on with the feedback.
That night, cutie called a cab. She left her east side room so drab.
Baby, don't do it.
She went out on the town. No, they will make her love a frown.
Death cab for cutie. Death cab for cutie.
Someone's gonna make you pay your fare. The cab was racing through the night.
Baby, don't do it.
His eyes in the mirror keeping cutie in sight.
Baby, don't do it.
When he saw cutie, it gave him a thrill. Don't you know, baby, curves can kill. Someone's gonna make you pay your fare. Judy, don't you play with fate. Don't leave your lover alone. If you go out of the state, his heart will turn to stone. Bad girl, cutie, what have you done? Slip and sliding down a highway 31.
Baby, don't do it.
The traffic lights change from green to red. They try to solve, but they both wound up dead.
Death cab for cutie. Death cab for cutie.
Someone's gonna make you pay your fare. Someone's gonna make you pay your fare.
Someone's gonna make
you pay your fare. Someone's gonna make you pay your fare.
That was Death Cab for Cutie by the Bonzo Dog Band. That's the song that the band Death Cab for Cutie was named for. That's back from about 1966 and originally came out on Fantastic Black Plastic. So on with the feedback.
Hey, this is Richard from Wichita, and this is another message left from my cell phone while driving on my car, now on my way back home, after several days down in Oklahoma and spending some time at the Trek Expo. Listening to your D episode, and specifically Duck Soup with the Marx Brothers, absolutely loved it. I'm a huge fan of the Marx Brothers, and so I'm going to keep this short and sweet since I left a long message last time. I just want to say that you missed over a little bit of Groucho Marx's career, and I just wanted to highlight that real quick since I know a lot about the Marx Brothers and Groucho. After they completed A Night in Casablanca in 1946, Groucho actually started with his solo career with a movie called Copacabana, released in 1947. And then Chico and Harpo were going to do Love Happy in 1949. While filming Love Happy, the financiers got a little worried because it wasn't a Marx Brothers movie, so Groucho was pulled into it, and that is why when you watch that movie, Groucho really seems like a secondary thought. He's merely kind of a narrator and in the background. Not the best Marx Brothers film, and probably the only noteworthy thing about that is that it was the theatrical debut for Miss Marilyn Monroe. Now, after that, the Marx Brothers were done with their theatrical films, but Groucho kicked in the next couple of years, actually, next several years, with two of his probably best solo efforts. Definitely B movie efforts, but 51 and 52. Girl in Every Port, which co-starred William Bendix, Life of Riley fame, and then Double Dynamite, which starred a very young Mr. Frank Sinatra, and, Rosalind Russell? And that's probably wrong. In any case, they're fun. They're definitely not as good as the Marx Brothers films, but definitely highlight that part of Groucho's life where he was also becoming well-known. He was already well-known on radio for You Bet Your Life and had started doing the television work. He did the pilot for the TV show, I think, as far back as 1949. Anyway, loved your discussion on it. Duck Soup, one of the all-time best Marx Brothers films, best comedies and best films of all time, really, if you look at all the various lists and if you go for that sort of lists kind of stuff. I loved your discussion on this, and I hope that as you're working your way through the alphabet, that maybe you have an opportunity to squeeze in something from Laurel and Hardy, another love of mine. I don't know if you're a fan of Laurel and Hardy, but I think it'd be great if you choose another of the Marx Brothers contemporaries at the time. There's a lot of, good films you could take a look at. Probably the best, it's not a full-blown film, it's a 30-minute film called The Music Box, which I'm sure you're well familiar with, 1932 Academy Award-winning Best Short Subject of the Year. That would be, that'd be fun, very lighthearted. Probably not, you couldn't go that in-depth, though, with that kind of film, so maybe it wouldn't be a good pick, but I don't know. Food for thought. I know you probably have everything picked out, and you have a gazillion films to choose from, but in any case, thank you for a stop in the zaniness of the Marx Brothers, and I hope you had fun at your convention down under. I know that I had fun at mine. I had some great one-on-one experiences and opportunities to chat with people, and I had a good time with my folks. So, loving the show, keeping me busy as I'm in the southeastern part of Kansas in the middle of nowhere. Thank you, sir. Take care. We'll talk to you soon.
Hey, Richard. Yeah, thanks for that. Duck Soup, interesting film and a lot of fun. My eyes just fell upon my copy of Memoirs of a Mangy Lover by Groucho Marx as I said that, because I'm here in the library, literally surrounded by books. And, so I'm glad that you enjoyed it, and I'm glad you enjoyed the convention down there. I know you go down there every year and give us a little bit of a report about it. So thank you for that. Laurel and Hardy, I'm not sure I'm going to do Laurel and Hardy. They're not that nuanced. I mean, they're interesting, both interesting human beings, Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy. And their life stories are interesting. But as you said, it's a little difficult to do those ones. And to be honest with you, I'm not enormous fans of them. And without that passion, I'm not sure I could do them justice. I understand that people like them. And I always love getting recommendations, some of which I use. Duck Soup itself was a recommendation. But if I don't do the movies that are recommended to me, it doesn't mean I don't value the recommendations, because I very much do. And I love the feedback of that. I love the interactivity that we've got here. And I want to enhance and keep that going as long as I want to do this. And it could be decades, who knows? The future is a fucking mystery. But thank you very much for that, Richard. And thank you again for your support with the podcast. I always love that, mate. So thank you. Okay, on with the next bit. I got an email again from Rob Kelly, so thanks, Rob. I always love your feedback, mate. Terry, another fine episode. Very glad to hear you talk about the Iger section. I think it's a great movie, one of the really strong, really solid string of flicks Eastwood did from the late 60s into the early 1980s. After college, I got a job at a great video store. We had almost everything, and one of the perks was unlimited free rentals. I decided to send myself to film school, so I went through our Hollywood's Best section, which consisted of films grouped by star and in some case director. I spent about a week or two watching every Clint Eastwood movie, and the Iger section was one of them. I love its terse, no-nonsense tone. Such a far cry from the overheated shoot-em-ups that were running on cable at the time. Really became a Eastwood fan during this time, and this film was one of the main reasons. Take care, Rob Kelly. Yeah, thank you for that, Rob. I had a coughing fit while I was reading that out, and I kind of had to cut out a lot of hacking and coughing and spluttering and sputuming. So I apologise if that sounded a little less than my usual readings of these things. But yeah, I mean, Eastwood is one of those guys that I like some of his stuff. I don't like all of his stuff. And I think that his work as a director later in life is quite interesting, in some ways more than the stuff he did as a star. But having said that, while I was up in Darwin in March, I watched Dirty Harry again, about 90% of Dirty Harry, the last 90%. And I kind of enjoyed it too. I'm going to have to watch the Dirty Harry films again because they were quite enjoyable as kind of action flicks and as a kind of reflection of a certain mind space at the time they were made. So, yeah, I'm going to have to revisit some of Eastwood's earlier stuff. I do like him in Paint Your Wagon because I love the fact that he can't sing worth shit and neither can Lee Marvin, and yet they're both starring in a musical, which I like. And so, yeah, thank you very much for that. I've got another voicemail now. Just let me line that one up.
Hey, what's up, man? It's Brother D from Mail Order Zombie. I don't know, have I ever called in before? If I have, it's been a really long time. Anyway, I've been listening to the show forever, and love it, and I love the Alphabet series, ABCs, or AB Data Z Project. It's fantastic, and Eyes Without a Face, man, that is such a damned creepy movie. I love that movie. I haven't seen it in a long time. Let me clarify. I don't feel like it's something that I need to see very often because it's so damned affecting and it sticks with me. And just the image of her wandering around the house with that mask, just her eyes. And like you said, it's sometimes hard to pull audio from a movie that is so visually based. But this movie has got some wonderful visuals. But as you said, it's not all visuals. There is one hell of a score. I'm going to mispronounce the name. And I'm embarrassed to say it because I collect film scores and I should know better. Maurice Jarre, he's the composer on this. And his score, at times, gets as haunting as the images on screen in Eyes Without a Face. I first became aware of his film scoring music when I saw The Mosquito Coast, which is miles apart from Eyes Without a Face. But anyway, I started wondering a little bit more about him and his music. Obviously not enough to pronounce his name right, but yeah, the score is fantastic. The movie is great, and I love the series, and I can't wait to get to the back half of the alphabet, because like, what movies are you going to find that start with the letter V or X or Z or Z? Anyway, keep doing what you do. Love the show. Stay loose and stay safe, and I think I'm going to go watch a zombie movie now. Peace.
Hey, Brother D. Yeah, thanks for that, mate. You have once before voicemailed to the podcast, so yes, thank you very much for that. I must owe you a few by now listening to Mail Order Zombie, which I recommend that everybody does. You guys are a class act, and you cover the waterfront incredibly well with what you do. So what am I going to do for the V's and the X's and the Z's? Vertigo comes to mind right off the top of my brain. For the V's, X is pretty much covered. I got X, the man with X-ray eyes, with Ray Milland. Z's piss easy. I've got Zardoz, I can do. And there was another one too. I've just forgotten what it is now, but I've got a couple of Z's. And so I'm going to be able to cover these pretty damn well. I may have to go into foreign language for them to cover some of the letters of the alphabet, but I kind of mapped out a rough one when I first came up with the idea. Can I cover those hard-to-do letters? Can I cover the Q's? Can I cover a few other bits and pieces there? And yeah, I can. I've worked it out. I can definitely do it. And I'm looking forward to it. And one of the nice things about the A to Z project is that in order to find the movies for each particular letter, I really do have to get outside my comfort zone of movie watching just a little bit. And I like that kind of stretching things a bit. I'm really into that at the moment, expanding myself as a movie viewer apart from anything else. And doing the radio gig that I do once a week kind of really helps me with that in an odd way. to be honest with you all, this is a fantastic part of my life right now. I'm doing the things that I should be doing. I'm doing the things that I'm passionate about. It's not making me any wealthier to do them, which is okay. I mean, you've got to have your passions, and whether the passions are monetarily based or not isn't as important as the fact that they're passions. So I'm really, really in a nice place right now, and some of it's thanks to you guys as an audience, and I can't dismiss that. There, if I had done this for the 4 years I've done it with no feedback at all, I would be mad by now. But the feedback itself is very much an important part of what I'm doing, and over the next couple of months I will be getting guests in, so it won't be just me in a room talking to myself in the hope that somebody at some far-flung part of the planet, and they are getting increasingly far-flung, listens to it and enjoys what I do. So I've got one last email. He said, finding the last email from Maurice Brzezinski here in Melbourne, and we haven't met yet. We've really got to do a meetup at some stage. Maurice says, "Hey Terry, I went the weekend to see the new Terrence Malick film, The Tree of Life. Not sure whether this film would have the needle pointing high on the Frostometer. Certainly a number of people walked out of the film during the session, probably as many as I saw walk out of Snowtown, which would be as far removed from The Tree of Life as you can get. This has no conventional narrative, and folks walk out either due to having their bullshit detectors up or they didn't have the story laid out for them on a silver platter. Personally, I loved it. I won't pretend that I got it all, but I'm willing to give the film more viewings to try to work it out. If you have to describe anything remotely narrative about it, then superficially you could say it's about a father's difficult relationship with his sons. The opening dialogue speaks about people going the way of grace or the way of nature. The father, played by Brad Pitt, lives his life through both schools of thought. If you do see the film, I look forward to your thoughts. Hope all is well with you. I'm enjoying the A to Z project and the chats with Ivor Cole. Look forward to hearing your guest chats on the podcast, especially with Dr. Zom. Cheers, Morris." Yeah, thank you for that. I am going to see Tree of Life. I don't know when, whether it's going to be on DVD or whether I can see it at a sit-down. But it's definitely going to be something that I will get a copy of and will watch. As I said, at the moment I'm really into expanding my horizons, and Malick is definitely on that agenda there. And I have heard good things. I know David and Margaret at the movies really gave it a good, interesting review. And it kind of intrigued me with that. And I do like watching Brad Pitt develop as an actor. I think that arc from pretty boy to solid character is going to mean that 20 years from now, Brad Pitt movies are still going to be watched by people and still enjoyed by people. I don't think he's going to go to the television route or the direct-to-video route. I really think that his choice of material is often very, very intelligent, and that he does have the chops to bring to the game what's necessary for this kind of film. So, yeah... And I just watched him in Ocean's 11. I'm already watching the Soderbergh Ocean movies because I just picked them up on Blu-ray and because I'm feeling like being shallow at the moment. But thank you very much for that. And thanks for your support again. And we will do a meetup at some stage. I don't think I'm getting to the Melbourne Film Festival this year, even though there are some interesting movies there. But there are times when I don't do crowds very well and I'm not organised enough to buy tickets ahead of time and all that sort of thing. So, I will kind of make a list of the movies that are at the festival that I want to check out at some stage in the future, which I often do with the festival. But one of the other things I'm going to do, just to let people know, in September, in fact, on Salon and my wedding anniversary, our fifth wedding anniversary, we're going to see Louis C.K., from the TV series Louis, do a live gig at the Athenaeum here in Melbourne. So that's, I'm looking forward to that because I really enjoy that series, particularly the second series of Louis, the sitcom. It's just kind of taken television comedy in a new direction that's very, very interesting. So if you get a chance to check that out, it's on my recommendation list. It's not conventional narrative comedy in the usual half-hour comedy sense, but it is good stuff. So, but that's what I should mention too. But going back to Brother D for a moment, I've just looked through the movies that Maurice Jarre did the soundtracks for. Eyes Without a Face was his second one, and his third one. immediately after Eyes Without a Face, he did the score for Lawrence of Arabia, and then went back to do a few things. He did Judex, another movie for Franju, The Train, The Collector, Dr. Zhivago, Is Paris Burning, Gambit, Grand Prix, The Professionals, Topaz, Ryan's Daughter. I like the Ryan's Daughter soundtrack a lot. The Man Who Would Be King, The Last Tycoon, Shogun, Firefox, The Year of Living Dangerously, Dreamscape, Top Secret of all things, Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, The Mosquito Coast, of course, Cocktail, Gorillas in the Mist, Jacob's Ladder, The River Wild. Yeah, the guy's got chops, and he's always got a beautiful richness to the soundtracks he does, and they're always perfect for the films that they're in. So, yeah, maybe I should do another soundtrack episode at some stage in the future, along with the other 58 projects that I've got for this podcast. Anyway, that's about it this time. Next time around, we're doing the G's, and I've got a couple of G's lined up already, but I'm not going to mention what they are. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for listening. I will be putting out on the Facebook page and on Twitter when you can stream the live audio of me talking with Ivor Cole about various movies. There is going to be a little bit of overlap with the podcast, I'll be honest with you. I am doing for the radio a few movies that I have done for the podcast, but I'm also doing movies that I haven't done for the podcast. And Ivor's a great guy to listen to, and he's a great movie buff and a very, very nice human being as well. And I'm not saying that in any kind of bullshit media sense. Genuinely, he is a lovely guy. So anyway, that's about it this time around. Sorry if I sound a bit rough, but I'm still getting over the flu bug I've got. Take care of yourselves. Keep your powder dry. Keep your muskets out of the rain. And I will catch you very soon.